The holidays are almost here. And if you still have names in your list, don't panic. Uncommon Goods makes holiday shopping stress-free and joyful with thousands of one-of-a-kind gifts you can't find anywhere else. You'll discover presents that are meaningful and personal, never rushed or last minute. Uncommon Goods looks for products that are high quality, unique, and often handmade or made in the U.S. Many are crafted by independent artists or small businesses, so every gift feels special and thoughtfully chosen. Uncommon Goods has something for everyone, from moms and dads to kids and teens, from book lovers and sports fans to foodies, mixologists, gardeners, and even the morbid curious. So you'll find unforgettable gifts that are anything but ordinary. When you shop at Uncommon Goods, you're supporting artists and small independent businesses. Every purchase is a chance to choose something remarkable and feel good about where your money goes. And with every purchase you make at Uncommon Goods, they give $1 back to a nonprofit partner of your choice. They've donated more than $3.1 million to date. I bought my girlfriend this awesome handcrafted nightlight for her office, which I'm super excited to watch her unwrap. And don't worry, she doesn't listen to this show. Something about, like, she already hears enough about me talking about ghosts at breakfast or something. I don't know. So don't wait. Make this holiday the year you give something truly unforgettable. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/hauntings. That's uncommongoods.com/hauntings for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited time offer. Uncommon Goods, we're all out of the ordinary.
The sun was shining brightly on the late summer day of August 14, 1817, off the coast of Gloucester, Massachusetts. It was still early in the morning, the best time for fishing, and across the water, several dozen ships were plying the trade, dropping their nets into the sea and raising them, teeming with a fresh catch. Aboard one vessel, Matthew Gaffney helped to lower the nets once more, and as he did so, he spotted an unusual movement a short distance off the bow. Gaffney was an experienced fisherman, but what he saw puzzled him. Whatever it was large, and it didn't swim like any fish he'd ever seen before. Matthew leaned forward against the rail and called out to one of his mates. He pointed wildly at whatever was moving just below the surface of the water, and both men stared as the strange beast finally broke the surface. According to an article written in the Boston Daily Advertiser, the sighting was initially dismissed as a, quote, creature of imagination. But over the next 12 days, the giant creature entered Gloucester Harbor, one of the most prosperous fishing ports in New England, and was seen by hundreds of people. Eyewitness accounts stated that the creature was between 50 and 70 feet in length and had a white underside to its dark head, which was about the size of a 4-gallon barrel. It periodically raised itself from the water, but moved with great speed and could whip itself around to move in the opposite direction in an instant. The Salem Register newspaper reported that the sea monster left a wake that was a mile and a half in length as it moved through the water at tremendous speed. Matthew Gaffney, after spotting the monster, fired his gun at it, but the musket ball seemed to have no effect. It sank out of sight and then reappeared nearly 100 yards away. More sightings followed. A judge, a doctor, and a naturalist collected testimonies from witnesses to the daily sightings that occurred. One man described the strange sea animal as having a head like a horse with the facial features of a rattlesnake. It seemed to move in a straight line, traveling around the harbor in wide circles. The whaling and fishing community of Gloucester was home to plenty of men who knew about the sea and the creatures that existed there, and they were baffled. However, on the second day of sightings, four boats of adventurous sailors and gunners went out after the monster with harpoons, guns, and nets. These men also claimed they struck the creature with musket balls, but once again, it vanished under the water, seemingly unhurt. The creature was sighted again a few days later, and this time, Observers claimed it was even larger than initially thought, some swearing it was 150 feet long. Speculation began all over New England about the nature and intent of the sea serpent. No one had ever seen anything like it before, or so they believed at the time. Stories of sea monsters were usually considered to be nothing more than legend and myth, and yet here was a beast like the legends, just offshore from Gloucester. It spawned fear and anxiety, and a variety of meanings and omens became attached to the sightings that occurred. Like some great sea beast from the biblical book of Revelation, many tried to invest it with meaning. To the veteran fishermen and whalers of Gloucester, the sea serpent was just another mystery of the sea, one that's never been solved. But to the devoutly religious of the region, the arrival of the creature at Gloucester was seen as something dark and ominous. The Puritans claimed to have encountered sea serpents long before the 1817 sightings in Gloucester. They placed dark religious meanings to the appearance of a creature off their shore. In 1638, a settler named John Joslin reported that recent arrivals to the colony had seen a, quote, sea serpent or snake. Another man, Obadiah Turner, described the same creature and worried that this monster from out of the sea might be, quote, the old serpent spoken of in the Holy Scripture, whose poison hath run down even unto us, so greatly our discomfort and ruin. The monster could be a portent of divine judgment, but it wasn't likely. Most believe that a monster plying off the coast of Massachusetts could mean only one thing, that the devil was still lurking in the darkest corners of New England, waiting to lure the unlucky to their deaths. Welcome to American Nightmares, the podcast dedicated to the history of horror in America. Through sinister tales of murder, madness, mayhem, spirits, scandals, and sins, I'll be presenting the origins of American terror with true accounts of frightening witches, mysterious monsters, haunted houses, death and dying, and stories of revenge and despair that have been torn from the pages of our haunted past. American Nightmares is written and performed and produced by Troy Taylor, that's me. And we're beginning with the horror at the root of the stories that kept the early settlers huddled around the fire late into the night. That is, of course, the devil himself. This is episode 4 of American Nightmares. The sightings of the Gloucester sea serpent occurred more than a century after the last witches were hanged by the Puritans at Salem Village, but not all that much had changed. For one thing, the incident at Salem was not the last American witch hunt. It was also not the end of Puritan oppression in the region. That would leave a lasting impact on both New England and American history. And no aspect of Puritan experience remains as strong in American memory as their fear of monsters, specifically their fear of witches that led to the trials of hundreds of settlers during the 1600s. The Salem witch trials have become infamous, of course, and for most of us today, they seem to be a brief flirtation with an irrational past. But there was nothing irrational about Salem to the Puritans. They hunted monsters for a generation before Salem, believing that strange creatures lurked in the, quote, howling wilderness. They imagined their religious experience as a war with monstrous beings birthed by the devil. It was a struggle with the forces of darkness that turned the New World into a place teeming with such monsters in the minds of the Puritans. Minister Cotton Mather helped to construct this new mythology that not only included the bones of long-ago giants, but also the claim that the native people of North America had a special relationship with the devil. They'd been seduced by Satan, he claimed, and this made them, in a literal sense, the children of the devil. Other Puritan leaders reinforced this view, seeing the Native Americans as a special trial designed for them by the devil. Frequently, the Puritans turned to the Old Testament imagery of the Israelites destroying the people of Canaan for descriptions of their relationship with the indigenous people of New England. The Puritans believed you could not live or convert monsters. You had to destroy them. And the Puritans found more monsters in the New World than witches. Although we tend to picture these grim religious fanatics in their equally grim meeting houses disproving of anything resembling magic and wonder, not all was as it seemed. The colonists believed in a variety of folk traditions, astrological beliefs, and ideas about monsters that had been brought with them from Europe. They told stories of monstrous births, signs and omens, and shape-shifting beasts that haunted the edges of their settlements. Predictably, Puritan leaders saw any portents of nature as signs of New England's divine mission, but we'll come back to that soon. The same clergyman, just as predictably, attributed a diabolical character to any magic and wonder that didn't fit into their beliefs. For the Puritans, it came as no surprise to find the forests of New England were populated with mysterious creatures and that they were surrounded by evil spirits of all kinds, as numerous, Cotton Mather claimed, as the so-called frogs of Egypt. And among those evil spirits were the mysterious figures that began wreaking havoc in the Massachusetts Bay Colony in 1692. Not coincidentally, many believe, the same year that people in Salem Village hanged 19 witches and crushed another one to death. When the first mysterious figures appeared in the woods around the community of Gloucester, it was assumed they were part of a French or Native American raiding party, which was not unexpected. England was at war with France, which had led to frequent attacks on the more isolated colonial settlements by French soldiers and their Iroquois allies. So when strange men began to be seen in the surrounding woods, the villagers armed themselves and took refuge in the shelter of a fortified garrison. This was a sensible response to something that turned out to be beyond the senses of anything the people of Gloucester were prepared for. The attackers boldly advanced on the village, and for 2 weeks there were alarms, ambushes, and pursuits. Still, the mysterious raiders seemed immune to the effects of the settlers' muskets, and apparently to the laws of gravity, and perhaps even those of time and space. They appeared without explanation and vanished just as easily, leaving nothing behind but a single bullet that was lodged in a hemlock tree and a scattering of footprints. These sinister strangers were like nothing America had seen before, and nothing like anything we've seen since. Gloucester, which would later be menaced by that sea serpent, of course, was founded on Cape Ann in 1623, just 3 years after the Pilgrims landed at Plymouth. It was the first seaport on the East Coast and eventually became an important center for fishing and shipbuilding. Before it gained prominence, though, it was a simple community of rugged colonists who worked hard for their existence. Their simple way of life is perhaps what made the encounters with the phantom attackers, because I can't find a better description for them, even more disconcerting. The strangers first appeared in a remote area east of town. The farms there belonged to the Babson family, which included Ebenezer, a bachelor in his mid-20s, his mother, and several relatives. The events began in late June and started as odd sounds heard in the Babson house at night. But on July 7th, things became more worrisome. Ebenezer arrived at his home late in the evening. As he approached the house, 2 men came out of the front door and ran into a nearby field. Well, startled, he hurried into the house to make sure everything was all right, and his family told him they hadn't seen the 2 men. If they'd entered the house, they'd done so without making a sound. Well, since he didn't recognize the men, Ebenezer took his rifle and followed them. He crossed a field and approached some trees on the other side. As he got close, the two strangers suddenly emerged from behind a fallen log and ran into a nearby swamp. As they ran, Ebenezer heard one of them say, quote, "The man of the house is come now, else we might have taken the house." Well, the men vanished into the darkness, and Ebenezer ran home, fearing that the two men had lured him away from the house so that others might attack his family. So he was relieved to find that everything was peaceful at home, but he insisted that everyone pack their things and come with them to the garrison in the village. On the way, he would warn others of the strange men. Well, soon the family, along with some of the other villagers, were locked into the garrison. They had just secured the door when they heard several men outside. Their voices were unfamiliar, and Ebenezer threw open the door to confront them with a pistol in hand. He spotted two men, maybe the same two men, running down a hill and back into the swamp. Confrontations like this continued for the next month. Defenders chasing the attackers, attackers chasing the defenders, with lots of shouting and firing of guns, but no one came close to actually capturing or even getting a close look at the mysterious men. On the night of July 9th, though, Ebenezer Babson was walking toward a meadow when two figures came running toward him. He later said they looked like Frenchmen, whatever that means. Since one of them was carrying what he described as a bright gun on his back, Ebenezer retreated to the garrison. Locked inside, the settlers heard movement outside and noises like stones being thrown against the walls. Within days, the entire village was fortifying itself in the garrison each night. It was only here they felt reasonably secure. The structure had thick walls of stone, two floors of solid wooden planks, narrow slits for rifles, and a fence of upright logs surrounding it. During the daylight hours, the villagers worked at their homes and fields with weapons close at hand and returned to the fort at night. For some time, no one but Ebenezer actually saw the attackers. They just heard them. Then toward the middle of July, Babson and a man named John Brown were in the garrison when three of the strange figures appeared. They fired at them with their muskets, but the men vanished into a cornfield. The strangers appeared and vanished repeatedly for hours, but the bullets fired by Babson and Brown never reached their intended targets. Both men were known for being better than average shots, but they were just unable to hit the attackers. On July 14th, the villagers were in the garrison when a half dozen of the strangers appeared at the edge of the fields. One of the men stayed behind in the garrison to watch over the families, and the other set off in pursuit of what they still assumed was a raiding party of Frenchmen. Two of the strangers ran out of the field, and Babson tried to fire at them, but this time, his gun refused to go off. As the trigger clicked hollowly, he called out to his fellow villagers, alerting them to the presence of the strangers. The other men came running to his position, and Babson saw three of the attackers emerge from the swamp. One of them, he said, was wearing a white waistcoat. Ebenezer approached the three men within about 30 feet and attempted to fire his musket again. This time, it went off with a thunderous roar, and all three of the strangers fell to the ground. Somehow, he'd managed to wound or kill all three of them with a single shot. Or so he thought. Babson ran toward the place where the men had fallen, and as he got close, all three men suddenly jumped to their feet, and one of the men fired a gun at him. The bullet buzzed past Babson's ear, and he ducked behind a tree to reload his musket. He called out to his friends, and the other villagers came running to his aid. As they approached, the strangers retreated toward a nearby field. Babson raised his gun and fired again, aiming for an attacker that was climbing over a wooden fence. The bullet struck him, and the man flipped over the fence to the other side, crashing into the corn. Babson and the other villagers ran to where the man had fallen, but he was gone. They searched the surrounding field and saw no trace of the man or his blood. He had simply vanished. They searched for several minutes, and then an eerie sound began filtering through the corn. The sound of whispering chilled their blood. It seemed to come from all around them and was in a language that none of them recognized. Terrified, they retreated to the garrison and didn't venture out again that night, even when shadowy figures were seen lurking at the edge of the woods. The trouble began again the next morning at sunrise. One of the attackers came out of the woods and stood at the edge of the field, within easy range of a musket shot. A man named Isaac Swan snatched up his long rifle and fired, but it had no effect on the stranger. He simply turned and walked back into the field. The families in the garrison were now paralyzed with fear. They needed help, and Ebenezer Babson volunteered to go down to the harbor. He planned to round up more men to launch an offensive against the raiders. As the others watched for the figures, Babson slipped out the door and began running toward the harbor. He'd only traveled a short distance when he heard a gun go off. A bullet whistled past him, cut off a piece of a pine bush, and lodged into the trunk of a hemlock tree. Babson saw four men hurrying toward him, and he raised his musket and fired. Ducking off the trail, he plunged into the woods and kept running until he reached the seaport. There, Ebenezer managed to convince six men to come back to the garrison with him, and they combed the woods as they walked back, looking for any sign of the strangers. They found the pine bush that had been clipped by the bullet and saw where it had lodged into the tree. One of the men dug it out with his knife and gave it to Babson. It seemed to be an ordinary musket ball, although it had been badly warped after impacting with the tree trunk. When they reached the garrison, Babson showed them the footprints that had been left by the strangers and related what had been happening at the edge of the village. As the men looked over the scene, one of them saw a man with long dark hair pulled back and tied and wearing a dark blue coat standing at the edge of the woods. He pointed out the stranger and the figure suddenly turned and disappeared into the trees. They chased after him, firing several shots without result, and briefly spotted another man who he said looked like a Frenchman once again. Several men fitting the same description were spotted later that same day by a man named John Hammond. He was scouting the edge of the woods and saw a figure wearing a blue shirt, white breeches, and, quote, something about his head. We don't know what that means. On July 17th, several of the strangers approached the garrison, and although the men inside shot at them, the gunfire had no effect. Later that same day, Richard Dolliver and Benjamin Ellery left the garrison to try and spy on the strangers. What they saw was exceedingly odd. They claimed that several men came out of a nearby orchard, walking back and forth, and were using a stick to strike the house of John Rowe. Ellery noted there were 11 men in the group. Dolliver raised his rifle and fired toward them, but none of them fell. The strangers simply turned and ran off in the opposite direction. The news of the strange happenings in Gloucester eventually reached the nearby town of Ipswich, and on July 18th, 60 men were dispatched to try and assist with the situation. Among the men sent by Major Appleton was John Day, who later described his experiences. When the men arrived, they heard shots coming from the nearby woods and went in the direction of the sounds. Day said that he saw a man with bushy black hair wearing a blue shirt running out of the woods in his direction. Day was close enough to shoot, but the woods were so thick he couldn't get a clear shot at him. The bushy-haired man escaped, and Day went to the muddy spot to look for the man's footprints, but there was nothing there. The presence of the small militia from Ipswich did nothing to discourage the attackers. They continued to appear almost every day. On July 25th, Ebenezer Babson was in a field gathering his cattle and saw three of the figures standing on some rocks looking out toward the sea. One of the men had a gun strapped across his back. Babson decided to try and ambush the party. He crept silently through the bushes until he was less than 40 yards from their position. He very carefully aimed his musket and pulled the trigger, but once again, nothing happened. He pulled the trigger a dozen times, but the gun refused to fire. At the sound of the trigger clicking, though, the three attackers turned and began slowly walking in Babson's direction. But they did nothing to threaten him. In fact, aside from a few glances, they didn't pay any attention to him at all. They passed by and vanished into the forest. This was the last time the strangers were seen. The villagers remained at the garrison for several more days, but the mysterious men never returned. Eventually, the militia decamped and returned to Ipswich, and the villagers of Gloucester slowly went back to their normal routine. The weird incidents of the mysterious men were soon only recalled as a strange oddity of the summer of 1692. But who were these strange men? Where did they come from and where did they go? Were they really French soldiers intent on menacing the people of Gloucester? If they were, a group of armed men spent nearly 3 weeks panicking the people of Gloucester for no apparent reason and at great risk to themselves. There was apparently nothing really strange about the men's appearance. Their black hair and blue shirts, not uncommon, and neither was their speech, other than it was an unknown tongue. The settlers assumed they were French, however, no one reported hearing them speak in French. The only statement that anyone recognized was when Ebenezer Babson heard them speak in plain English about the man of the house coming home. Assuming this was a hostile raiding party, why were no homes burned, no residents harmed, and no property stolen? Why were the raiders not reported anywhere else? Why was no campsite ever found during the villagers' searches of the forest? The strangers surrounded the village for almost 3 weeks and left nothing behind but a handful of footprints and a single musket ball. This was really an inept raiding party if all they did was shoot at Ebenezer Babson a few times. The rest of the time they spent wandering around, banging on things, throwing rocks, hitting John Rowe's house with a stick of some sort, and allowing people to shoot at them and chase them into the woods. But if they weren't enemy soldiers, what were they? Were they supernatural figures of some sort? Well, the accounts of the incident make even the most skeptical wonder what really happened there in 1692. The men appeared and disappeared, almost at will. They rarely left any sign behind. No bullets ever seemed to bother them, and in most cases, guns aimed in their direction often refused to fire. When Babson believed he shot the man on the fence, he found no trace of a body or any sign of blood. The mystery of these sinister strangers remains unsolved to this day. Well, for us. The religious residents of Gloucester believed they knew who the men were, of course. They were the evil spirits that Cotton Mather and others had warned them about. Beings that were undoubtedly agents of the devil. Thanks for listening to this episode of American Nightmares, part of the American Hauntings Podcast Network. If you like the show, we hope you'll consider checking out the other shows in the network, along with some of the books from American Hauntings, as well as some of the events and happenings that we have coming up. I mean, right now, through December 14th, we have our annual holiday sale going on, which means you can get 20% off any upcoming dinner and spirits events that I'll be hosting in the new year. I'd love to encourage you to skip the ordinary gifts this year and treat the spooky people on your list to an experience they won't forget. These events are held at the American Oddities Museum and include dinner and an evening of eerie tales, haunted history, true crime, and the unexplained. Just go to the website at dinnerandspirits.com and use the promo code HOLIDAY when you check out. This discount is good for dinner and spirits events only. And remember, the sale ends on December 14th. So book now and give them a night they'll be talking about long after the holidays are over. Coming up on December 13th will be the last day the American Oddities Museum will be open at the Mineral Springs Hotel in Alton. We'll be closing after that and reopening at our new location on January 17th. So stop by for your last chance to see our Mineral Springs location that Saturday. I'll be in the museum all day signing last-minute holiday books and saying goodbye to a place where we've been doing events since the 1990s. And finally, be sure to check out the website for the 2026 Haunted America Conference. It's now up and running and features this year's roster of speakers and presenters, after-hour events, tours, ghost hunts, workshops, and everything else you need to know. On December 8th, vendor spaces for 2026 go on sale, and they always get snapped up quickly. So if you're planning to have a booth this year, you don't want to wait too long to get that booked. General admission tickets for the conference will go on sale starting January 12th. And with that, I'd like to say thank you again for checking out the latest episode of the podcast. I hope you loved it. And if you did, please share it with your friends, your family, people you work with, anyone you think would love it too. And as a thank you, we've always got that discount code. That's just one word, podcast. That gives you 10% off any books, tours, or events you purchase from our online store. Because we're, well, more than just this podcast and the other ones we do. We're also books, tours, ghost hunts, dinner events, the Haunted America Conference, the American Oddities Museum, and a whole lot of other stuff. You can find everything about us on the website, AmericanHauntings.net. So stay tuned for the next episode of American Haunt Nightmares. Oh, I almost messed that one up, didn't I? Stay tuned for the next episode of American Nightmares and let us know what you think of the show by leaving a review or texting a comment to the Haunt Line at 217-791-7859. We appreciate your continued support for every aspect of American Hauntings. We couldn't and wouldn't do any of this without all of you. And your comments and feedback mean a lot to us. So good night, good luck, and I'll see you next time. Just be sure the devil doesn't get you first.